What is going on, family of 1 week season? I am JM to win. It's Friday night. Welcome to the week seven angles podcast. So one of the benefits of working from home is that even when I work a 75-hour week, as I've had to every week of NFL and for the month and a half leading up to NFL so far, I don't have to set an alarm, but today that meant that my body told me to get a little more sleep than normal. So, starting the Angles pod a little bit late. I woke up at 4:40 in the afternoon, as opposed to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I guess that's not that different. But it was a bit crazy to wake up and realize that I'm usually recording the podcast at that point. Grab some water. I already had my notes laid out for the pod, and we're diving right in. Try to get this up as quickly as possible for you guys. So before we dive into the slate, one thing that I was thinking about last night, Thursday night, was I was working on rosters, and I was thinking about something that I talked about that a lot of you heard in the DFS process course, where I was talking about different rosters that I'd built when traveling and different big weekends that I had had when traveling. And I was thinking about that because, for example, Levitan hates travel. I mean, I don't think he does travel during football season. There's been maybe one or two events that I can think of in the last 5 years that he's left home during football season. And just being in that rhythm, and I've talked to several years ago, talked to Al Smizzle about the same thing. And he essentially said it was when he was working with ESPN, and he was saying that with all the travel back and forth, he had cut down on his play quite a bit because he just didn't play as well when he didn't have his home field advantage, so to speak. And so I was thinking about that fact that a lot of my really strongest weekends have been travel weekends. And thinking about why that is, and obviously thinking about whether that's just completely random and a coincidental, or if there's something to it, if there's some sort of shift that happens on weekends when I'm traveling. And there has been enough volume and a high enough hit percentage on weekends when I have stuff going on that I consider it to be more than coincidental. And so I was thinking through, okay, so what mindset shift happens when I'm on the road versus at home? And one of the things that I was thinking about was just that when I'm at home and I have a little bit more time to work on rosters, and by a little bit more time, I mean I put in probably 20 hours a week just on rosters. And so when I have that kind of time, there's this sense in my mind that I can get down to just the perfect plays at every position. And what ends up happening is I can sometimes just get a little bit too rigid, a little bit too tight, a little bit too by the book with my plays. Whereas when I'm traveling, there's a little bit of extra room for me to take on some uncertainty. And that's something we've talked about on the site since we launched, is the value of embracing just at least a little bit of uncertainty on your rosters. And so, as we always try to talk through things and try to improve our play, one of the things that I hear from people is essentially, well, I keep getting a lot of the right plays, but I'm just not getting them on the right roster together. Or if I'm building one or two rosters, I'm just having one or two guys on my rosters each weekend who are just kind of killing me. And a lot of times those are the plays that are your highest confidence plays and your plays that you're refusing to get off of, which is again in the course why we talked about moving stuff around in your roster toward the end of the week, challenging your roster, carving your roster, and finding ways to take it to another level. Because when you have one of those players who you just never take off your roster all week, they're lock and load, you never challenge that player. Well, if that player has a bad game, after the fact, there's two ways to look at it. Either, well, I was never going to get off that player, and so he had a bad game, I'll just live with it. Or you could say, oh, I never even challenged that play to try to make 100% certain that was the play. And so sure, one play might be the most obvious, but maybe that play is only a little bit better than another play that nobody's thinking of, or maybe that play isn't even better than another play right by it that nobody is thinking of. And it's those types of plays that are much more difficult to pull the trigger on, because those are the types of plays where you're on the guy and then you're like, well, nobody's talking about this guy, and maybe the things I'm seeing here are wrong. And so you end up not taking that play and going with the safer play instead. And the more time you have to work on your roster, the easier it can be, especially if you lost money the weekend before, or lost money the previous two weekends, or haven't had a big weekend yet. You can get tighter and tighter in your play and lean more and more toward these safe, unaggressive plays that feel good to lock into your roster. And then you can look at your roster Saturday night or Sunday morning and kind of be like, well, yeah, I feel really strong about all these plays. But a lot of times that isn't what you need to reach first place in a tournament. A lot of times what you need is one of those rosters where there's at least a couple guys on the roster where you're like, man, I really don't know about pulling the trigger on this guy. Now, feeling that way isn't the be-all and end-all of what you need on your rosters, obviously, because it has to be a good player who's making you feel that way. So there's the research that goes into it. There's all the other process steps to go into finding good plays first. And then when you're putting those good plays on your roster, if they're the players that you're saying, man, I don't know about pulling the trigger on this guy, a lot of times those are the types of plays that you actually need to have to win a tournament. And so for me, because I'm convinced that I can figure it all out, if I give myself, you know, no distractions and all this time, it's easier for me to kind of lock into safer plays. Whereas when I'm on the road, it's easier for me to settle on a play and just say, okay, you know what, I'm going to roll with this guy. I know he's a good play. I don't really know how I feel about him, but I know he's a good play, and we'll see what happens. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. And that maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong is necessary in order to win a tournament. And in fact, the larger the tournament field, the more uncertainty you have to be willing to embrace. So I know that personality-wise, and this is another thing we talked about in the course, obviously, is that the field talks about these big picture ideas and never talks about what types of contests they apply to or what types of players they apply to. And so it can be really confusing to try to sort through that for the type of play that you're taking on. But if you're playing smaller field, single entry stuff, if you're playing bankroll building tournaments, it's important that you recognize that even in those, you need to take on a little bit of uncertainty. You need to take on some of those plays that make you feel less safe and comfortable, plays that are still good plays by the research, by the numbers, but for whatever reason, you're having a hard time going to that play. And those are the plays that are a little bit easier to pull the trigger on when you have less time to overthink things. And those are the kinds of plays that can make a big difference between a mediocre weekend and a big weekend, or a big weekend and a tremendous weekend, and so on and so forth. Now, another thing on that is we talk about bankroll building tournaments. And so it's important to highlight this. You know, everybody falls into a different category of DFS player, DFS goals. And so I know that there are some of you listening to this who DFS is literally just a hobby. It's nothing more, and you're not interested in it being more. You put in a few bucks a weekend, and if you hit, great. If you don't, it's not that big of a deal. You put in a couple hours because you enjoyed it. You built a roster you liked. You got to sweat games, and that's what you were after. And that's awesome, because that's the category of player that you are comfortable being in. It doesn't mean you can't hit, but it means that you're not going to be putting in extra time to, quote, try to get better at this, because there are other things that rank higher up the priority list than that. But to those of you who are in that category where you're wanting to get good at this, and you feel like you're putting in time, you feel like you're putting in effort trying to get good at this, and then you're wondering, well, okay, either why is this not working out the way I want it to, or why is it not working out to the full extent that I want it to, or why am I less consistent than I want to be? I want to encourage you to ask yourself if you're doing everything you can do. And I don't mean putting in more time researching stuff and building rosters. I mean getting better at building bankroll. And so again, when people say, well, I've had three straight losing weekends, and then it's like, well, okay, so what have you been doing? And then it's all DraftKings large field play. And this is why we talk about bankroll building tournaments, smaller field tournaments, single entry tournaments. This is why we talk about fantasy draft, playing on. If you're going to talk about, well, I haven't had the weekend I want to have yet, I'm not making money, and then you're not playing on fantasy draft, it's like, well, you're not taking the steps to build bankroll. I mean, I wrote this down, right? So what do you play each weekend? If you play $10, if you play $10 a weekend, you're saving $20 in rake throughout the year playing on fantasy draft. If you play $50 a weekend, you're saving $100 a year in rake playing on fantasy draft. We can keep going up. You save about two full weekends worth of buy-ins. Think about that. That's incredible. That essentially means that you get two free weekends a year from playing on fantasy draft. You're buying in for 15 weekends and getting two weekends free. A couple of different people let me know that fantasy draft charges a 3% deposit fee. So I didn't let you guys know that before because I already had money on fantasy draft and wasn't aware they were doing that now. So apologies for not mentioning that before. But even with that factored in, it's a one-time deposit fee of 3% as opposed to 10 to 15% rake every single time you rebuy with those dollars. This 3% is calculated into this savings that you have. If you're playing $1,000 a weekend, you're going to save $2,000 throughout the season just from using that money on fantasy draft instead of somewhere else. And so before you say, well, you know, this isn't working out, or, you know, a lot of times a bad season is you're about one or two weekends worth of buy-ins down. So if you're one weekend of buy-ins down and you've been playing on fantasy draft, now you're one weekend of buy-ins up. On top of that, it's softer competition, so you're probably up more than that. But it's another thing we talked about in the course. You know, it's saying, okay, so maybe I'm not going to hit for a 20K cash this weekend, but you know where it's a lot easier to build bankroll really quickly, where it's a lot easier to get those 50K payouts, is in small field, high dollar tournaments. And the way to play in small field, high dollar tournaments is to build your bankroll through smaller field, lower dollar tournaments, to build your bankroll through overlay, to build your bankroll through rake-free play, to build your bankroll through all the different places you can find to build bankroll. And so you might go from playing $20 a weekend this year to playing $60 a weekend next year to playing $150 a weekend the next year to playing $1,000 a weekend the next year. And that's kind of how this goes, and it might happen faster than that. Especially if you're playing other sports, it's going to happen faster than that. If you're playing showdowns, it's going to happen faster than that. But that's the progression. It's not let me enter the millionaire maker and hope I hit for $1 million and then I play in high dollar tournaments. It's finding ways to take on, it's finding ways to build bankroll in just clear, obvious, straightforward ways. And if you focus on that, it's going to happen. If you focus on that, you're going to come out of the season with more money to play with next time around because you're taking the right steps there. So those are a couple things that I wanted to talk about at the front end of this week. Embrace a little bit more uncertainty on your rosters. Again, you're going through the process, so you're not focusing on bad plays. So if you get to Friday, Saturday, you're building rosters and you have a good player pool, or you're leaning on the NFL edge and building your player pool from there, or even just waiting until the player grid comes out and using that as your player pool, you're building around good plays. And so at this point, it's taking some of those good plays that have a little bit more uncertainty, those good plays that are a little bit more difficult to stick with, and then paying attention to the patterns of sort of what goes into your roster. So what types of players end up paying off based on the guys that you are scared to play. Because again, as we talked about in the course, people talk about gut feeling, and then there's discussion about, well, does that matter? And as we talked about, gut feeling is just all of the information that you have gathered. It's all the things that you already know. So if you follow the patterns in your thinking, you're going to start finding certain types of players that strike fear in you in a certain type of way, and find that that fear is a player who is actually paying off more often than not. You can look and see, okay, week in and week out, when I feel this type of fear about a player, I end up not rostering him, and that player typically has a strong game. And finding those types of things are valuable because you start to realize, okay, here are my blind spots. Here are the places where I'm being a little too cautious. Here are the types of research that I'm being a little too unwilling to embrace. And this guy's still a good play based on this research, but because it's this type of research or these types of numbers or this type of player, I'm a little too scared to pull the trigger on him. And this is the type of player who is consistently keeping me from profit, the fact that I'm not rostering this guy. So you start finding things like that. Once you start paying attention to these things, embracing a little bit more uncertainty. And then the other thing is, find those ways to gain an edge. Find those ways to build bankroll. You know, I'll say this before we move on. I was pretty surprised and a little bit disheartened by the traffic numbers on the defensive identities page that we posted as part of the course. And then we also added it on every NFL Edge game. It's in the DFS 201 tab. And it's something that most content providers don't know. And so it's something that's a very clear and obvious edge. And if you're going to say, well, I'm not doing as well in DFS as I want to do, I encourage you to ask yourself, am I doing what I can do? Am I looking at things like the defensive identities page? You can find the link at the bottom of every single write-up in the NFL Edge. You can find the link at the very top of the DFS 201 page. Am I finding something like that that literally no other site has, and that literally most content providers don't know, so very little of my competition knows it? Am I seeking out pages like that and adding that information to my edge? Am I moving some of my play to fantasy draft where I get two free weekends of buy-ins and adding that to my edge? And so it's things like that that are actually going to make a big difference. And so anyhow, if you're wondering why you're not making as much as you want to make in DFS, I encourage you to first ask yourself if you're doing what you can do to take advantage of the edges that are available to you. The next edge that's available to you are bottom-up build. So because I started late, I'm going to try to keep this to about an hour and 10 minutes total. That way you guys aren't too far behind on listening to this, any of you who listen right when it goes up. So for the very few of you who are new here, what we do here is we're going to build a roster starting from the bottom up with salary. And we're going to take the players that we would feel comfortable, we're going to find the most savings that we can take with a roster that we would feel legitimately comfortable playing. So it's not who are the cheapest guys that we could stomach rostering, but who are the cheapest guys that if we left this guy on the roster, we would feel really good about the fact that we were rolling with that guy. And maybe he's not the guy that we want to prioritize. Maybe he's not the guy that we feel most confident in. But who are the guys that if these end up being our foundation pieces, if some of these end up being our floor plays, that we would feel really good about rolling with these players? And then how much salary do we have left over from there? And what does that enable us to do moving in different directions? So really cool week this week. We have some injury news that could bounce some things around, but generally speaking, things are pretty settled at this point. The biggest question mark is David Johnson, who is being called a game time decision. If David Johnson is out, obviously Chase Edmonds becomes a premium piece on a bottom-up build. So keep that in mind, but we're going to assume right now that David Johnson's playing. And we have a roster with 5,200 left over in salary this week. So for those of you who build along with, go ahead and pause, pull up the DraftKings app, or the DraftKings on the desktop, and let's get started. So, side note here, typically I pause in recording whenever William's crying, but he's been having, he's been sick off and on the last couple weeks and has been traveling a lot and is not having a great day. And we don't want to delay you guys on this podcast, so if he starts crying, just handle the background noise, I guess. He's on a different floor, but the sound carries. All right, so we're going to start this roster this week at quarterback. And this is actually something that we have at a number of positions. There's a couple players below the guy we're going to land on who I wouldn't mind in tournaments if I had to shift around salary and go down below this guy. But as far as an optimal bottom-up build, going down below this guy isn't the way we want to start. And so what we're going to do this week is the players who are kind of below the ones we're choosing, we're going to hit on those also while we're choosing them. And then obviously at the end, we'll shift around some salary and look at where places where we might be able to go up. So at quarterback, the places where I wouldn't mind saving salary, there's three guys, and it is Gardner Minshew, Andy Dalton, and Jacoby Brissett. So Brissett is the guy I like the most out of the bunch. He's 5,600. He's playing Houston, which is a pass funnel spot at home. And additionally, there's an element here. Well, a couple elements here. The Colts have had their bye week, really great coaching staff to help them get ready. Because this is a divisional game that's so important to both teams, and because the strength of the Texans is their passing attack, we should expect the Texans to get progressively more aggressive throughout the game. We should expect the Colts to come in expecting that. So the Colts will probably have a game plan that entails putting up points as opposed to just shortening up the game and bleeding out the clock. And then T.Y. Hilton's in a good spot. So a lot of elements that make Jacoby Brissett a solid play this week. Obviously, at his price tag, you want him to get at least 22 points, which he's gotten above that mark twice. He's gotten 23.5, 23.8. So he hasn't gotten you those smash spots. And given the way that this offense is built, those will be outliers. That's why he's not on our bottom-up build list, because his chances of getting a 30-point game are lower than the guy we're going to land on. But if you need the savings and you want to say, okay, maybe all these other quarterbacks only get about 25 to 26 points and maybe Brissett gets me 23 to 24, I think he's a guy you can definitely go down to. So less likely, obviously anything can happen in the NFL, but less likely to get a 30-point game than the guys priced above him, but he's a fine fallback option. Dalton and Minshew are a little bit less safe, but Cincinnati, we know, throws the ball as often as any team in football. We know the matchup's not bad. Really, the big thing holding Dalton back is lack of weapons. You know, Tyler Boyd is kind of miscast as a number one. Auden Tate and Alex Erickson are kind of miscast as pieces to be relied on in the NFL. And so this offense looked really good when John Ross was on the field as far as their ability to pick up yards, their ability to pick up explosive plays. And so that's gone away a little bit at this point, but you're probably still getting 15, 16, 17, 18 points from Dalton. And it just takes an extra touchdown for him to pop up above 20 points, 22, 23. Minshew in the same spot. We've talked about, obviously, the way to attack Cincinnati is on the ground. But when Minshew takes to the air, he should be able to gain some points with his legs if his receivers are covered. He should be able to gain some points through passes to Leonard Fournette. And it's obviously not impossible to get passes to the wide receivers in this spot. So Minshew, same as Dalton. You know, you're expecting 15, 16, 17, 18 points. And if he pops above that, you're going to feel really good. The quarterback we're going to land on is Daniel Jones at 6,100. And Daniel Jones really has about the same floor as those guys. He's not going to get you, you know, we can look and see the 11 points against Minnesota and 8 points against New England. Well, that's Minnesota and New England, and we shouldn't be too concerned about that. 14 points in a blowout against Washington. The beauty of this matchup is that you know that the Cardinals are going to play fast. You know the Cardinals are going to pick up yards. It's highly likely that the Cardinals score points, which means the Giants are going to have to try to score points in response. And one of the best ways to do that will be through the air, will be through Daniel Jones picking up yards with his legs. And so Daniel Jones is a guy, he's not the guy who I'm focused on. He's not the guy I want to play at quarterback this week. But at 6,100 for a bottom-up build, you're exposing yourself to a pretty solid floor. It will be surprising if he falls below about 16 points in this spot. And that would be a really disappointing output. His likeliest range is around 20, 21, 22. But Daniel Jones is a guy who can get you 30 points. He can produce, as we mentioned in the NFL Edge, he has an outside shot at producing the highest quarterback score on the slate. And that's what you want on your bottom-up build, is a guy who can get you a ton of points, a guy who can win you a tournament. So 6,100, Daniel Jones is the first guy we're locking in on this bottom-up build. The next place I'm going to go is wide receiver. And a lot of times we save wide receiver for last because it's the most volatile position outside of defense. And defense is, as we've seen this year, defense is less volatile for us because we actually understand how defenses play and we actually understand how that matches up with opponents. In fact, our hit rate for defense has been remarkably high this year, almost fluky high this year. But defense, as we've seen, doesn't have to be as volatile as the field views it as being. So wide receiver, and I'm not seeing people really talk about him, but Alan Lazard, it just doesn't make sense. Even if Marquez Valdez-Scantling plays, it just doesn't make sense for Lazard to not be on the field. Furthermore, this is a spot, and I know that we can't rely on Matt LaFleur to realize this because he wants so badly to run the ball and he's so certain that's the way to win football games, is to set up the pass with the run. But Oakland has been tough to run on this year and they've been really easy to pass on. And even if Rodgers throws just 30 times and we have 7 of those targets going to running backs, 8 targets going to running backs, that still leaves 22 targets to be spread around. And I'll tell you, Marquez Valdez-Scantling does not have a lot of nuance to his game. He's a great downfield receiver, but that's where his production comes. And so when you're looking at moving the field, when you're looking at passes at other levels of the field that are going to help you move downfield, Lazard really stands out. He did a lot of things. We talked about in the NFL Edge about Rodgers kind of stumping for him this last week and trying to get him on the field, Rodgers calling plays for him. There was a spot where they had 2 different plays that could have gone 2 different ways, and Rodgers asked for the play that went to Lazard. Also, the pass to Lazard downfield. This was in a beat writer article. It's not something I spotted on film, so I'd like to give credit, but I don't recall which article it was I saw this in. So, but they pointed out that the touchdown pass to Lazard, that Rodgers had a open option underneath, the play was probably designed to go to, and threw a much tougher throw. In fact, by Next Gen Stats, it was considered Rodgers' lowest likelihood for completion pass on the season, the touchdown pass to Lazard. And that was where Rodgers decided to go instead. And so that level of trust on an Aaron Rodgers offense stands out. It's important. It matters. So we're guessing here, right? But we're guessing at $3K in salary. And what we're guessing is, firstly, that even if MVS plays, there's no way that Lazard is on the bench and Darius Shepherd is on the field. Again, we're guessing. This has been speculated among beat writers that Lazard has earned an opportunity, that Lazard is going to be out there. But the Packers haven't said, yes, this guy is starting this week. If we're talking about tournaments, right? So if you don't feel comfortable going with Lazard and cash, I understand that. If we're talking about tournaments, it's actually optimal if we never get that news. It's optimal because this gives us a chance to embrace some uncertainty that other people are not going to want to take on. And this is a guy who, even if he gets you 10 to 12 points, he got what you needed him to get, but he has a realistic shot at 15 to 20 points in this spot. So we should expect Rodgers to get about 250 passing yards. That's the likeliest range. And we should expect about 70, 80 of those passing yards to go to running back. So this isn't some smash spot or take all the cheap wide receivers if MVS is out, because you know, you're not getting 20 catches for 250 yards out of, in two touchdowns out of these guys. You're not getting 60 points out of these three receivers combined. But one of these receivers should put up 15 plus points, and Lazard is the best bet for that score. So bottom up build, he's going in. And we're going to skip over talking about the wide receivers between Lazard and the next two guys that we take, because there are wide receivers that you could dig into the numbers and justify. Jerron Brown's going to get 5, 6, 7 targets this week. Feels point chasey because he scored 2 touchdowns last week. But I'll say this. Jerron Brown in that game is a guy I included on a couple of large field builds because he has an actual role in this offense and is getting targets, and any player with a role in this offense is valuable. And so, you know, we know that his floor is low. We also saw last week that he has some ceiling. This week, if Marlon Humphrey is on Tyler Lockett, Brown could go from his typical 4 or 5 targets to 5, 6, 7. So there are plays like that down here, right, where we just had to give disclaimers and maybe this guy can hit this. But we're running into a lot of that. Damir Byrd, maybe he, you know, he only played 15 snaps last week, so maybe he gets back out there for more snaps. Maybe he gets back up to 5, 6 targets like he was getting earlier in the year. But those 5, 6 targets were getting him 8 yards per catch, right? And so, again, there's just a lot of things that we need to go right on some of these cheaper wide receivers. So if we're going to talk bottom-up build, we'll go all the way down to Lazard for that uncertainty that we have to embrace, especially because this is a guy who does have a shot at 8 targets, right? Would it shock you if Lazard came out of that game with 8 targets? No. Would it shock you if Jerron Brown came out of the Seahawks game with 8 targets? Yes. And so we're going to go all the way down there, and then we're going to skip over the rest of this uncertainty and get to this 5K price range, where there are actually a number of different guys that you could highlight and move toward. A couple of the ones that we're going to leave off this build are Brandon Cooks, Allen Robinson, Tyler Boyd, and Golden Tate, and Robert Woods. And all of those guys have cases to be made for them. All of those guys are talked about in the NFL Edge. All of those guys will be in the player grid with some placement. But the guys who really stand out here, the really strong plays, are T.Y. Hilton, and we probably don't even need to go into that one. There's just a lot of things that set up well in this spot. We talked in the NFL Edge about how his targets give him floor. Again, his chances of a 100-yard game are low given his role in this offense. So he's not a yardage and touchdowns guy, but he has enough speed to still bust out for a big play. The targets are there for floor. So if he disappoints, he's probably getting you about 10 or 11 points. And then his, you know, yardage and touchdowns is where we get upside. And his red zone role is so secure that the touchdown likelihood is high enough that he still becomes a ceiling piece in this spot. So T.Y. Hilton at 5,900 is a guy I feel very comfortable locking into a bottom-up build. I don't think that he's a must play. I think that there are ways that you can move off of him and go up to different guys. But he's a really – I mean, you can't build a bottom-up build without T.Y. Hilton, who's just underpriced at 5,900. And the other guy who just stands out as the most underpriced here is Kenny Golladay. And Kenny Galladay's recent salary is 6K, 5,900, 6,600, 6,600, 6,300. And with that, he's posted 20.1 points, 23.7, 3.7, 28.7, 14.2. So you take away that 3.7 point game, and your worst game is 14.2 points. And as we talked about in the NFL Edge, the Vikings aren't limiting catch rate for opposing wide receivers. They're not forcing teams to throw the ball to the short areas of the field. They're just great at preventing yards after catch. That's why they've still been good against wide receivers this year. And Kenny Golladay and Marvin Jones don't really get yards after the catch anyway. So is there some risk? Lower total game, good defense, good secondary, definitely some risk. touchdown upside is lower in this spot. But can Golladay catch 5 passes for 100 yards in this spot? Absolutely. Can he turn one of those into a touchdown? Absolutely. So like Hilton, he's not – some lock and load must play. And it's rare – it's really rare that a wide receiver is, right? Because there is a lot of volatility at wide receiver. So much goes into a wide receiver play, and so much has to go right for a wide receiver to hit as far as game environment and plays breaking down. I mean, go back and watch some games. If you want to get a better understanding of this, go find some monster outputs from this year, wide receiver outputs, and then go watch the games to see how those outputs came about. And you'll see a lot of instances where this, where a play breaks down and there's a scramble play and this guy ends up hitting for a big gain. And without that play, he's catching 5 passes for 45 yards. And with that play, he added another 70 yards and a touchdown. Or instances where, you know, coverage breaks down and the guy is just left wide open. Or instances where the guy's big play or big plays were plays where he was the second or third read. If a guy is getting a lot of his production from touchdowns and it's not schemed looks, so you can watch T.Y. Hilton's touchdowns and they're typically plays designed to get him open and designed to go to him. There are other guys who get a lot of touchdown production and they're just plays that break down, which is what often happens inside the 10-yard line, inside the 5-yard line. You have this tight field and it's second down or third down, you need a pass to the end zone and the quarterback just buys time and enough time develops for somebody to come scraping across the back end of the end zone and make some toe-tapping catch. And somebody does that 2 times, and all of a sudden they have a monster DFS game. So again, wide receiver, there's a lot of volatility at the position. So neither of these guys are lock and load options. But when we're talking about price and the savings that we're getting and the upside we're exposing ourselves to, we're in a really strong spot with Lazard, T.Y. Hilton, Kenny Golladay as our wide receivers. The next spot I'm going to go to is, we'll jump over to running back next. And we'll jump here because there are some high-priced guys that we'd like to get up to. A lot of high-priced guys are in a really good spot. Saquon Barkley's in a good spot. Dalvin Cook's in a good spot. If he plays, David Johnson is in a good spot. But we can't just start by going up to those guys. So I am going to, who's the most underpriced player on the slate? It's Leonard Fournette. So I'm actually going to break the rules a little bit and jump up above. We're going to have a cheaper running back as well. I'm going to jump above that guy and first put in Leonard Fournette because you could choose multiple cheaper running backs. But again, bottom-up build, we're wanting to say, what's the roster we would feel really comfortable rolling in with? And so Leonard Fournette, he has averaged 19.1 DraftKings points per game, and he has scored 1 touchdown this season. So you think about the amount of usage-driven scoring that he's getting. And I know that he had those slower games at the start of the year. Those stand out as like, look, his actual floor is still down here at this 14-point range, 14, 15, 16-point range. But if you get 18 to 20 points from your running back, regardless of what you paid for him, well, unless you're paying that 8,900, you know, that Saquon Barkley, Christian McCaffrey level. If you're paying 8K and below and you get 20 points, is that what you need to win a tournament? No. Is that what you roster that guy for? No. But you still feel fine with 20 points. If you can get – it's hard. It's really hard to get 20 points in DFS. So if you can get 20 points from each guy on your roster, you're going to feel really good about the roster that you set up, even if these higher-priced running backs didn't hit for the score you wanted. So Fournette's likeliest range is still 16 to 18 points in a floor game. Great setup. It's a team that filters touches to running backs. It's a team that filters targets to running backs. And it's a team that allows a lot of big runs to the edge. We know that Fournette's specialty is big runs. We know that the Jaguars can use him on the edge. So will we be bummed if he scores 16 points? Absolutely. But as far as a guy who's on the field, you know, 95% of the snaps and is going to get 25 touches more than likely in this spot. There's just a lot to like about Fournette at his too low price of 7K. I will also note, however, if you want to look for a reason to fade Leonard Fournette, touchdowns do matter for upside. And as we noted in the NFL Edge, the Bengals, the one thing they've been good at is red zone defense. And the Jaguars have been bad at red zone offense. So it wouldn't be crazy to see Fournette come out of this game with three touchdowns. But it also wouldn't be crazy to see him come out with zero. And if that's the case, you know, we've seen he can still put up 20, had a 29-point game with zero touchdowns. And that was 225 rushing yards. But, you know, his games without a touchdown outside of the one with Denver were 17.8, 15.2, 12.7, 12.4. The game in which he scored a touchdown, he would have had 20.7 without the touchdown. So these aren't back-breaking scores if you miss out on them. There is a case, especially if Fournette's going to be ultra-popular, to say, you know what, I'm going to find a way to get up to Saquon and Dalvin Cook and leave Fournette alone and hope that he runs into another zero-touchdown game. But by the book, by the numbers, Fournette is the strongest floor-ceiling option really on this slate. If we move over to FanDuel, keep in mind he's a little bit overpriced, or he's priced up on there, I should say, not overpriced, priced higher relative to other backs. And again, FanDuel is more touchdown heavy. So again, is Fournette a strong play? Absolutely. Could you come up with some justifications for fading him? Absolutely. The next guy I want to go to is we're going to go down to this 5K range at running back. And there are a number of pieces to like down here. So you can make a case for Mixon. You can make a case for Josh Jacobs. The case for Josh Jacobs is obviously the matchup and that the Raiders really want to lean on him. Jacobs has a high ceiling. His floor is really low because they're just not involving him in the pass game. So I'm totally fine with Jacobs in tournaments. But bottom-up build, we're trying to get floor and ceiling. I'm going to skip over him as well. And what we have here is the two Bills running backs and the two 49ers running backs and Devontae Freeman. So I'm going to talk about these two 49ers running backs first. It's a good spot for the 49ers. Breida and Tevin Coleman should both see 15-plus touches or at least come really close to both seeing 15-plus touches. Raheem Mostert is currently questionable. So if he misses, again, he's had 4 and 7 touches in his last two games. So if he misses, that further solidifies the touches for these two guys. Neither of these guys are going on the bottom-up build. Why? Because Breida is the guy who is used for big plays. He's likely to be used in the pass game, and they are refusing to give him touches near the goal line. Tevin Coleman, on the other hand, is getting all the goal line work, but he's not as much of a big play threat on the ground. And he's really pretty uninvolved in the pass game. So we end up with a situation where the floor is spread out and the ceiling is spread out. So Breida's the guy who is likeliest to get you a 30-point game because he could bust a couple long runs, catch a pass and go for a big gain. And so he has a 30-point game this year, and he had, I believe, at least 2 30-point games last year, maybe 3 30-point games last year. So from a ceiling perspective, he's really interesting, but his floor is lower and his chances of hitting ceiling are lower because he has to score from far away. Whereas Coleman's floor is lower because he doesn't have the pass game work. He's not likely to have a big yardage game. And so then the touchdowns are giving him ceiling, but his chances of a 30-point game are lower because he needs something to break right with the rest of his usage, right? Even 2 touchdowns plus 60 yards rushing only gets you 18 points. So you need him to break through. You need him to catch some passes, break some long gains to hit for a 30-point game. I like both of these guys. They're very much in play, but they're not landing on the bottom-up build. The next guy is Frank Gore, who, again, it's likely that the Bills try to get Gore a touchdown against Miami. It's likely that they will have opportunities to get him a touchdown against Miami. And it's likely that he picks up another 15 carries, 16 carries, and 2 catches. And that's enough to push close to 100 yards. What we're probably not going to see is Gore getting 20 carries. And Gore probably needs about 20 carries to hit 100 yards, even in this matchup. So he's not going to land on the bottom-up build. It's an outlier bet for him to crack 100 yards and get that bonus. We're looking at more like 8 points on the ground and 2 points through the air and a touchdown. So about 16 points. Again, a really solid score. Anytime you can take 20 points, you'll take it. But we want to expose ourselves to potential for a 30-point game at every spot on our roster. Optimally, every player on our roster, we could look and say, could they get 100 yards and two touchdowns? Yes. Is it possible for this guy to get 100 yards and two touchdowns? Yes. And Gore's likelihood of that is much lower than some of the other running backs that we could go to. So he's not going to land on the bottom-up build. And the one I'm still sitting here trying to make a decision about as we're talking through it is Devontae Freeman and Devin Singletary. And Devin Singletary is a massive uncertainty embracer, because it's his first game back, and in his first two games with this offense, he had 9 touches and 6 touches. So at 5,400, we would be rostering him, optimally saying, this guy has to get at least 14 or 15 touches for us to feel like this was a worthwhile guy to roster. So I guess Singletary really doesn't belong on the bottom-up build, because he could get 8 touches, he could get 9 touches. But keep in mind that Miami has allowed an average of 35-plus running back touches per game. And the Bills probably aren't giving Frank Gore more than 20 touches. They have no need to give Frank Gore more than 20 touches. So the big risk here is that TJ Yeldon, that the Bills are a little scared to unleash Singletary in his first game back from a hamstring injury in a game that they should be controlling. So because of that, all right, I've talked us off of him being on the bottom-up build. Because there are chances, and again, Yeldon played only 5 snaps the first 2 weeks. Yeldon almost got cut in the preseason. This team really doesn't like what Yeldon is offering them. If Singletary is healthy and they feel good about him, he should get 15 touches. So I really like Singletary in tournaments this week, because Singletary with 15 touches against the Dolphins, and we don't know about goal line work, right? I would take 15 touches from Singletary against the Dolphins, which includes pass game work, over 15 touches from Tevin Coleman. I would take 15 touches from him over Breida, because he's likelier. It's a softer matchup than Washington, and he has a higher touchdown likelihood than Breida. I do like Breida quite a bit as well for tournaments, for the upside. But Singletary is just a really strong play if he gets those 15 touches. There are question marks on whether or not he gets those 15 touches, and that's the big concern with him. Devontae Freeman, we know he's going to get the touches. So 22 touches last week, 16 the week before, 20 the week before, 19 the week before that. And he's priced around all these guys that, as we talked about, are split backfields that are getting, you know, basically 50-50 backfields that we're looking at, you know, 15 touches apiece for these guys. Or in the case of Frank Gore, he might push for 20, but these are Frank Gore touches as opposed to Devin Singletary, Matt Breida touches. Devontae Freeman, and I will say, it just popped into my head, that could Gore score 2 touchdowns? Yes, he could. And that would be the reason to roster him and say, you know, maybe he gets up to 24, 25 points. Maybe the Bills just decide to go all out with him and get him 2 touchdowns. That would be the justification for going to Gore in tournaments. He does still have some upside there. Devontae Freeman is just really heavily involved in this offense. I know that snap count, you know, he's not much higher than some of these other guys. So we're looking at about 60% of the snaps. But what we really love about Devontae Freeman is that this team has become so pass heavy, and they've been involving him in the pass game. So recent target counts on the year of 4-4-4-9-5-3. And so if we're looking at about 5 targets in this game against the Rams, which is expected to be high scoring, we like that type of usage. And then on top of that, he's getting the carries. On top of that, he's likely to get work close to the goal line. And Ito Smith is on the field, right? But last week he touched the ball 3 times. The week before he touched the ball, 11. The week before he touched the ball, 4. He has a 7-touch game, a 6-touch game. He's on the field, right? But he's not on the field to take work away from Devontae Freeman. He's on the field to spell Devontae Freeman. And then Devontae Freeman comes back on plays where they want to use the running back to be the central piece for this offense. So at 5,400, Devontae Freeman is underpriced for his role. And if we take away, you know, slow start to the year, 5.1 points, 9.4 points, he's had scores that you'd feel really solid about at his price across the last 4 games. 12.5, 18, 18, and 26.8. So we'll throw Devontae Freeman on this bottom-up build. So if you're building along with, we've got Daniel Jones, Leonard Fournette, Devontae Freeman, Kenny Galladay, T.Y. Hilton, Alan Lazard, and 3 spots open. So those 3 spots open, and the first 2 are tight end, and those are really easy to fill because you have a guy in Hunter Henry who's a central piece to his offense and is probably seeing a minimum of 6 targets in this spot with upside for more and with upside on those 6 targets. So at 4K, you know, we talked to the NFL Edge, we'll talk some more in the player grid about reasons for moving off of Hunter Henry in tournaments and justifications for moving off of him if he's going to be super popular, which he probably will be. But from a bottom-up build perspective, Hunter Henry, look, the Titans aren't a great defense to attack, but the easiest way to attack them is with tight ends. The Chargers are a good offense. They're going to score 2 or 3 touchdowns in this spot more than likely, and Hunter Henry is going to be involved in them moving the field and hopefully in them scoring those points. 4K, tough to pass up. And we're going to throw in another tight end here because we have a guy at 5,300. And if you compare him to – this is Austin Hooper. If you compare him to the uncertainty at wide receiver in the 5K range, if you compare him to what we were just talking about at running back in the 5K range, Austin Hooper is just a guy that they've really liked getting involved this season. And we've typically been able to point to – the spots where his usage is going to go up. So he had 9 targets in week 1 against Minnesota. As we've seen throughout the year, Minnesota is most attackable with tight ends. He had only 6 targets against Philadelphia, only 4 for 34, and Philadelphia is a really tough team on tight ends. Indianapolis is a tight end funnel. He had only 7 targets, his 2nd fewest of the season, but 6 catches for 66 yards and 2 touchdowns in a spot that sets up well for tight ends. Tennessee, again, they are easiest to attack with tight ends. And what do you know? Austin Hooper had 11 targets, 9 catches, 130 yards in that spot. Houston, we've talked all year. Tayshaun Gibson has done a really good job covering tight ends. He's made this a difficult tight end matchup. And so Austin Hooper had 9 targets in that game, but caught only 6 for 56 yards. It was one of his more disappointing showings on the year. And then last week against Arizona, we know what Arizona's defense allows to tight ends. 8 targets, 8 catches, 117 yards, and a touchdown. And so this year, we've been able to comfortably see Austin Hooper's bigger games coming. And in this spot, again, the Rams have allowed the 7th most tight end yards this year, allowed the 3rd most tight end yards last year. And with Jalen Ramsey on Julio Jones, it likely takes away a few opportunities for called plays, schemed plays to Julio, which means a couple opportunities for schemed plays to other guys, likely Austin Hooper in a spot that sets up well for him. And opportunities for schemed plays to Julio where he's covered and Austin Hooper is the outlet read and gets the targets there. So Austin Hooper at 5,300, we get a high floor and a high ceiling. And then the last spot I want to go to, or we're going to go to, is defense. And 2,300 is where we're going to go. But before we hit on that defense, there are actually some defenses even cheaper than that that you could justifiably go to. And the 2 that stand out to me are, and I'll say this, what we like about defense and why we had a great run with defense this year is because we understand that aggressive defenses are likelier to produce strong fantasy scores. Aggressive defenses are likelier to get defensive touchdowns, rack up sacks, rack up interceptions, and get these 14 to 20 point games that we would love to get from our defense. We're also not going to find those defenses down at the bottom of the price range. The most aggressive defense down here is the Ravens, but they're playing Russell Wilson on the road. I'm going to trust Russell Wilson over the Ravens in that spot, especially given how the Ravens have looked this year. The next most aggressive defense is the Giants. Again, not a good defense, and they're facing a good offense, but Kyler Murray can take sacks. He can throw interceptions. He can make mistakes. So the Giants at 2,500, if you're looking for what's a lower floor, but could get me some ceiling down here. But generally speaking, if we're taking on cheap defenses, we're not saying that we're expecting to get a 12, 14 point game unless we just get lucky. But we do recognize that with defense pricing changing and these defenses so cheap, and with these defenses 1,500 to 2K below the defenses we can target for 12, 14 points, we just need a defense that can get us 5-6 points. And if these defenses can hold steady, not allow a ton of points or pick up a few sacks, pick up a turnover or two, we're going to be in really good shape because, yeah, we're only getting 6 points, but that 2K in salary, maybe everybody else is getting 12 points with their expensive defense, and that 2K in salary we can gain more than that 6 point gap somewhere else. So I still like the idea of getting up to the, you know, the defenses that we'll find in tier one on the player grid. We'll talk about that at that point. But if we're paying down, we just need defenses that can get us 4, 5, 6, 7 points. And so a couple that I like before we get to the Lions at 2,300 are Washington Redskins at 1,700. The Redskins are a mediocre defense. They're not an awful defense. You know, they're below average across the board, but they're not awful. And you can look and see 5 points against New England, 5 points against Chicago, 2 points against Dallas, 9 points against the Giants. This mediocre, right? We see 10 points against the Dolphins. So again, this is not some elite defense, but at home against a 49ers team that is mistake prone if they have to pass. Jimmy Garoppolo, I believe, already has 5 interceptions on the year. They're mistake prone if they have to pass, and if they have to run the ball, they're probably not, you know, if they take a lead and then they're just running the ball, we're not going to get that many mistakes, but they're also not just running up the score. And so Washington should be able to stick to this, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 point range at only 1,700. You can feel comfortable with that one. The Colts at 2K are a risk to give up 30 points. They're a risk to get into that negative range from points allowed. But they are playing Deshaun Watson. They have had 2 weeks to prepare. So Deshaun Watson is likely to take some sacks and, you know, has a shot at throwing at least one interception. So the Colts, if they get 1 or 2 turnovers and they pick up 3 or 4 sacks, they'll put you in good position. And then hopefully this becomes, you know, Vegas is implying this to be 24 to 23. Hopefully this becomes more of a game like that where the Colts then, you know, pick up a point from point prevention, and you're ending up in this 5, 6, 7 point range. The defense that I like, the defense that we're going to throw in this bottom-up build, is the Lions because they're a really good defense. And I know that they're up and down, they're hit or miss, and we can go through their game logs for points allowed, right? And they've allowed 27 to Arizona and 24 to Philadelphia and 34 to Kansas City and 23 to Green Bay. But there are mitigating circumstances on all of these. And I guess you could always say that with a Matt Patricia defense, because any Lions fans out there, I sympathize. I know what it's like. You're watching, you're like, man, this defense is good. How do we give up so many points? Because there's so much bend but don't break to the defense. In fact, I texted my dad right after the Monday Night Football game to tell him that the Lions had a classic, you know, Matt Patricia Patriots defense loss. And I know they got hit hard by those phantom penalties, but it's that thing where you're like, okay, we have to hold them out of field goal range. And then a few plays later, they're in field goal range. And then you're like, okay, we have to stop them and force a field goal now to get the ball back. and then they're picking up first downs and bleeding out the clock. You get that with Patricia. And that's why, you know, you can look and say, well, there are extenuating circumstances in all these spots, right? Green Bay, there was the penalties. Kansas City, the Lions did really well against them for most of the game. Philadelphia, the Lions did well against them for most of the game. And then Arizona, 27 points week one, you know, you're getting to know this new offense. The only team that the Lions have actually held down is the Chargers, held them down to 10 points. But this is a really good defense. Only 10 sacks on the year. They still need some help in the pass rush. They don't like to blitz. They're one of the lowest, you know, blitz rate teams in the league. They're going to drop seven guys into coverage, rush with four guys. But against this Minnesota offensive line with Kirk Cousins, and especially with the way that the Vikings like to run bootlegs and the Lions' ability to be disciplined on defense, we could have opportunities where you just have that one rusher out there one-on-one with Kirk Cousins when he boots out, and that's a couple sacks there and one or two others where this four-man rush gets to Cousins. And then you're going to have the Vikings leaning on the run, so you're not, you know, looking at a spot where we're likely to get 30-plus points from either team. And just a lot of things come together to where the Lions, again, should be able to get one of these 5, 6, 7-point games at only 2,300. But because this defense is so talented and because they're facing Kirk Cousins, I also like their chances of you know, turning in a big play, getting a defensive touchdown. And so we have some upside to go with things. 2,300 down here. So if we're moving around in salary, and we'll get to a lot of this on the player grid, obviously, but if we're moving around in salary, I want to hit on these real quickly, and then we'll hit on our game-by-game looks at alternate angles that we can consider for each game. So if we're moving around at quarterback, up from Daniel Jones, there's obviously Jared Goff's a solid play, Matt Ryan's a solid play, but the guys who are really catching my eye are these running quarterbacks at the top, and we'll skip over Josh Allen because, again, the Bills are trying to turn him into a non-running quarterback, and it's a good spot for him to not have to run. Obviously, there's upside, but he's not going to end up as a core piece this week. But I really like Russ and Lamar Jackson against each other, having to trade blows back and forth, and you'll probably at halftime, if you roster Russ, probably be disappointed at halftime with the score that you got from him, and then by the end of the game, feel good about it. And that's typically how things go with the Seahawks offense. Lamar Jackson, I just really like the, you know, crowd noise in Seattle concerns me, and the lack of weapons concerns me. It's really just Mark Andrews is the only guy who can really get anything going for Lamar through the air, but that just puts more on Lamar's plate. And I see this as a game where we could end up with Lamar taking over, getting 60, 70, 80 rushing yards, getting a rushing touchdown, and, you know, still picking up his 200, 250 yards and a touchdown through the air. So I like Lamar Jackson. Deshaun Watson, again, comes with a lower floor, and we don't love the spot at Indy, a team that has had 2 weeks to prepare for him. We're not expecting this to turn into a KC or Atlanta-style shootout. But when Deshaun Watson has to take over a game, good things can happen. So Deshaun Watson's on this list. And then Kyler Murray. I really like Kyler Murray this week against a Giants team that has just been bleeding points to quarterbacks on the season. And Kyler, his worst game was 17 points. And he has three games of 25-plus points on DraftKings. So you just get a really high floor to go with a really nice ceiling in this spot against a bad Giants pass defense. Would be great if Christian Kirk comes back and Kyler actually has more than one wide receiver weapon in the pass game, but he's been able to get it done regardless, and so I really like Kyler Murray up there this week. At running back, there's not much to talk about. We know who we like up at the high end of the price range. We like David Johnson. We like Dalvin Cook. We like Saquon Barkley. It would be great to – you probably want to have at least one of these guys on your roster. It'd be great to get up two of these guys, and there are pretty easy ways to do that this week. And then at wide receiver, there's not a ton that I love this week at wide receiver. But if we're moving out of that 5K range, the two guys who stand out to me the most are Will Fuller at 6,200. And we talked about the types of routes that he runs and how this matches up with the Colts defense and what they've had trouble with the last several weeks. Malik Hooker is going to be out again. And so that frees things up downfield still for Will Fuller. And yeah, it's just a good spot for Fuller to see a couple more downfield looks again. And we know that he comes with a lot of volatility, but the upside is there. And then Cooper Kupp in this game that, you know, we talked about the reasons why this game might, in the NFL, the reasons why this game might not shoot out. But we also know that more than likely points are going to be scored in Atlanta versus the Rams. This isn't going to be a 21-17 point game. We're going to get up into those, you know, high 40s, low 50s with potential for it to turn into, you know, a 33-31 game type of environment. Likeliest range, I think, is for this game to end up in the high 40s, low 50s. But with that, that's still a lot of points piling up. And we have an Atlanta defense that takes away downfield passing and that tries to filter targets underneath. Obviously, from a talent perspective, they're going to have some issues there. So we can still like Brandon Cooks. We can still like Robert Woods. But I really like Cooper Kupp in this spot. His targets are secure. His red zone role is secure. And we take out that game against the 49ers. And this looks like a really solid play all season long. You know, as 49ers, we know how good their defense is. So in a spot where we have a bad defense, there's a lot to like. Kupp's other bad game came in week one against Carolina, who's bad against slot receivers, but has a really good defense. And so from that perspective, you know, Goff completely struggled in that game. The Rams struggled as an offense in that game. And so from that perspective, you can say, okay, the chances of Kupp hitting a dud in this spot are low, and we know what his ceiling is like. And then we move over to tight end. Where do we want to move up in salary at tight end? Should go without saying. We have this guy named Evan Engram, who has been, you know, one of the best tight ends in football this year, one of the best fantasy producers in football this year, and he's playing Arizona. And I know he's been priced up, but when you look at the scores that Arizona has given up to tight ends, there have been a number of 20-plus point games against them so far this season. In fact, this is off the top of my head, so forgive me if I get any of these slightly wrong, but they would be only slightly wrong. I believe Hawkinson scored 29 DraftKings points against them. Mark Andrews scored 28. Greg Olsen scored 25. Will Disley scored 17. And then Austin Hooper scored, I believe it was 28. So Ingram's priced up, and you know, it's a tight end, which means a lot more short area passes. It's why we typically only pay up for somebody like Travis Kelce, who actually sees downfield work. And we love these 5K tight ends, because then if they just get short area passes and they catch 6 for 60, that's still not killing you at their price. And if they break some plays, you get a touchdown, then you're in great shape. So there is some risk in going up to a tight end at 6,500. Most of Ingram's work comes in the short areas of the field. So it wouldn't be shocking if he ended up with 8 catches for 65 yards and no scores. And at his price, that would be disappointing. But again, if you can get 20 points to every spot on your roster, you're feeling pretty good. You know, Ingram's chances of a dud are very low. His chances of pushing close to 20 points are very high. And as we've seen, you know, and Disley isn't the same athlete that Olsen and Mark Andrews and Austin Hooper and Hawkinson and Evan Engram are. And so, you know, Disley getting 17 points, that's almost like these guys getting their 27 points. So, you know, the chances of Engram getting one of these 25-30 point games are high enough that he's certainly worth the salary this week. And I like Engram quite a bit at 6,500. So that kind of does it for, honestly, we hardly need to write a player grid after that, because that's kind of the core of like bottom up and some of the places that we would want to go from there. And then who are the sharper plays above those bottom up plays? Obviously, we'll still have a player grid and we'll hit on all the other plays who are kind of in mind this week, but that's sort of the tightest group of players from what I'm seeing as of right now, Friday evening. And obviously we'll see what else ends up on the player grid and potentially added on Saturday night as well. Game by game. So again, any of you who first time listeners, we close out talking about large field types of plays. And we try to go game by game and look at some of the different angles of ways that the game could play out or players that people might not be thinking of and ways that you can incorporate some game by game setups for large field plays. So this is not to be used for single entry play and smaller field play, these thoughts, but if you are mass multi-entering or trying to win large field tournaments, here are some alternate angles to consider. We will start with San Francisco at Washington. Obviously, Kittle is in play here for the upside. He will be lower owned than Ingram because, you know, there are blowout concerns here, and it's not a matchup against Arizona, and Ingram is the better play. But Kittle could pass him, so Kittle's in play. But the angle that I like here is considering taking both running backs and just playing this as a game in which the 49ers completely dominate Washington and they put up, you know, 45 points, 50 points between the two running backs. Now, if Mostert plays this weekend, I would feel a little more iffy on this. But if he's out, I guess we introduce a little bit of risk that Jeff Wilson now comes in and gets his goal line work. But the likeliest scenario is that Breida and Coleman get the touches and that these guys would have a shot at combining for a nice game. It's a lower floor shot that you're taking, but it is something that nobody's going to be on. And if it pays off with 50 points, you know, you're putting yourself on pace for about 230, 240 points across your roster at the salary that you're spending for that. And you'd feel pretty good about that in large field tournaments. Next game is, and if you're wanting to follow along, we do this on the DraftKings app. So it's in the order that the games are listed at the top. You can click on any position and just go game by game right along with us. So the next game is Arizona at the Giants. So the first question here is, are shootout conditions ripe in this game? Not really, because you do have two teams that like to throw the ball in the short areas of the field. And so for totally ripe shootout conditions, you want a couple aggressive offenses. You want teams that are willing to, teams that are willing to attack downfield. With that said, both of these offenses, there's a reason this game opened with an over-under of 50 or 50.5, whatever it was. Both of these teams can rack up yards. Both of these teams can move the field. And what can happen in a game like this is that if each team starts scoring early, each team can start getting more aggressive because they start feeling like, okay, we need to score points. And so rather than trying to slow down the game, they try to speed things up. They try to attack downfield a little bit more. They try to look for opportunities to gain an edge because essentially you're saying, well, if we can just get this one touchdown, this one big play, and then stop them, then now we've gained the advantage. And so if you run into a situation where each team starts thinking that way throughout the game, we could easily end up with this being the highest scoring game on the slate. Now, the beauty of Atlanta and Arizona was that Atlanta is able to kind of drive scoring because they have so many explosive pieces. So Arizona goes in knowing they have to keep pace. In this spot, the explosive piece is Darius Slayton, who will have Patrick Peterson on him. And then you've got Golden Tate and Evan Ingram and Saquon Barkley being thrown to underneath, right? So again, the chance of this just turning into a 30-30 game are lower, but with these two offenses, it could absolutely happen. You could end up with a game that's tied at the end and you go into overtime and pick up, you know, another quarter's worth of fantasy production there. And so the way to play this Arizona Giants game for me is to just build some rosters in large field play that just build around this being an absolute shootout. You can do the same thing in Houston at Indianapolis. Is it less likely? Absolutely. But given what Houston has on the field, especially with Kenny Stills expected to be back, because Kenny Stills has a downfield role Will Fuller has a downfield role. So then that leaves DeAndre Hopkins as the short area option, but DeAndre Hopkins is so elite that he can turn short area looks into big plays. There are just opportunities here for the Texans to put up a big game on offense. Is it likeliest? No. But if it happens, then you have the Colts with T.Y. Hilton trying to keep pace in response. And there is a chance that this game turns into a shootout. Lower likelihood than Arizona and the Giants, but definitely worth keeping in mind in this game as well. The next game on our list is Oakland at Green Bay. And the obvious way to play this game is to bet on the Raiders leaning on Josh Jacobs and to bet on the Packers leaning on the running backs with all the wide receivers injured. So the alternate angle is to just go different direction. And again, the Packers should still throw the ball 30 plus times, 30 to 35 times. And some of those passes are going to wide receivers. So if Lazard has a big game, if the Packers jump out to a lead, if they force the Raiders to take to the air, and we saw it last week, the Packers, no teams want to run against them. So if they're able to sell out and slow down the run. And again, you know, Jacobs, this Raiders offense is built around running to the outside. That's where the Packers are best. So if the Raiders are forced to the air, you could go with Darren Waller. You could go with Trevor Davis. You could go with one of these guys who could break off a big play. And is this game going to turn into a shootout? No. But are there pieces from the Raiders who could end up having a good game through the air? Yes. And that's the way to play this game as far as taking a different look than the field is going to be taking. Minnesota at Detroit. So there's an interesting alternate angle here. Can both of these teams get over 30 points? That would be surprising. It would be shocking. But this is currently projected to be, I believe, a 22 to 21 game. As far as Vegas has this game, and maybe it's 23 to 22. In either case, could this game go above that? I mean, we walked through what the Lions have allowed this year, and they've had a hard time holding teams below 27 points. On top of that, we've talked about how, you know, the Lions are a vertical passing attack now and how they should be able to hit some downfield throws against the Vikings. So there are chances that this game could end up as more like a 28 to 27 game or even 31 to 27, 31 to 28. And that offensive pieces in this game could be more useful than the over-under is going to imply to the field. So I think that the field is going to kind of leave this game, not Dalvin Cook, but outside of Dalvin Cook, this game will go somewhat overlooked. And I think that it's viable to target some other pieces from this game as well. Next up, Jacksonville, Cincinnati. We really talked through the angles I would want to hit here when we talked about the quarterbacks. Not a lot that I like from the wide receivers in this game. Tyler Boyd is obviously the sharpest play, has a really solid floor and a decent ceiling. So Tyler Boyd, we know, is a player we could lean toward. We know Fournette's a player we could lean toward. But as far as alternate angles, the farthest I'm probably stretching is just saying, hey, maybe both these teams score four touchdowns instead of three, and maybe the quarterbacks are involved there. Miami at Buffalo, it's similar to the San Francisco setup in that you could take Gore and Singletary together. The problem is you have TJ Yeldon also in the mix that, you know, potentially TJ Yeldon still plays 15 snaps as they try to limit Gore below 20 touches and as they try to ease Singletary back in. So that's an angle you can consider. It's a little bit scary. The other angle is to say, you know what, maybe the Bills come out and they don't care about just trying to win this game. Maybe they come out off the bye and they just want to lay down the hammer and they want to unleash Josh Allen. And this passing attack just picks up a ton of points. John Brown becomes viable. Duke Williams becomes viable. Josh Allen becomes viable. Maybe even Cole Beasley becomes viable. And so that's an angle to play around with in large field tournaments. It's an angle that is, again, not ultra likely, but that just not a lot of people are going to be on. Next game is the Rams at the Falcons. And realistically, you know, we talked about maybe this game doesn't top 55 points. Obviously, it still can. I think that it's about 40-60 to top, you know, that high over-under of 55 points. But even if it doesn't, there are going to be points. So the question here is, how does everybody think those points are going to be scored? Well, everybody is going to assume that the scoring is happening through the passing attacks. The passing attacks is where the focus is going to be on this game. So the alternate way to play this, if you say, yeah, I expect points to be scored, but what's a way that maybe points are scored differently than the field is expecting, is you could just, something Zandomir talks about a lot in his showdown breakdown, is just say, assume that all the points come in a different way than people are expecting, and we get a Devontae Freeman, Todd Gurley game instead of a Matt Ryan, Jared Goff game, and that's the alternate angle I would look to here in large field play. Next game we have is Chargers at Titans. And in fact, Chargers at Titans, Saints at Bears. These are just two really low total games. We'll take them both together. Not a lot to love in either game. And in large field play, it's viable to just completely fade these spots and just say, you know what, these games are going to be so low scoring that my chances of a slate winning score are just really low. Obviously, we have Hunter Henry. You could talk about Latavius Murray against the Bears with Alvin Kamara now out. But as far as building around these game environments, I don't mind just leaving them alone altogether. The alternate angles to play is just coming up with the way that one of these games turns into a shootout. So again, maybe the Bears score some points early on. Maybe Trubisky has a hot start to this game, and then the Saints have to find a way to keep pace. We skipped over Michael Thomas when talking about wide receivers. Matchup isn't great, but Traquan Smith out, Alvin Kamara out. He does become pretty interesting in this spot just because targets are going to be there. I know he's expensive for the actual, like, likeliest scenario ceiling, but he is another wide receiver to keep in mind. But again, you know, you can look through high-scoring rosters. You can look through tournament-winning rosters, and you'll notice that a lot of times – tournament-winning rosters, their players come from higher-scoring games. And so it's not bad to just remove these games from larger field play and target games that have a higher-scoring likelihood. So that will end then with Baltimore at Seattle. Games that have a higher-scoring likelihood, we got Baltimore at Seattle, two teams with a vertical passing attack, two teams with explosive quarterbacks, two teams that can score in a hurry. And this is a game that obviously, you know, could be tightly contested and could be 24 to 21 or whatever. But this is one of those games that it shouldn't be surprising. You know, we looked at breakdown of Seahawks games this year. 55-point totals, 60-point totals has been consistent because the Seahawks are an aggressive offense. They attack downfield. And Russell Wilson is going to find a way to score points. And you could say that if Russell Wilson is going to find a way to score points, Lamar Jackson is as well. I wish that you could play both of these quarterbacks. Both of these quarterbacks are really interesting, and they work well together because if one scores, the other is likely scoring. Pieces from this game, and that's the difficult thing, is both of these teams score a lot of points. But you can look through DFS scores from the Seahawks in all these games where they're scoring 30 points and try to find how many have-to-have-it DFS scores were produced. Typically, it's Russ and nobody else, or Russ and Carson and nobody else. So Lockett is having solid games, but not games that you have to have. All these ancillary pieces, DK Metcalf and Jerron Brown, even Will Disley, they're producing solid games, but not games that you had to have, not games that are going to win you a tournament. It's the same thing on the Ravens. Mark Andrews is very much in play. He'll be on the player grid this week. And outside of Andrews, you know, you're like, well, maybe Ingram gets some touchdowns, but the floor is low. Maybe Boykin gets some points, right? Well, he hasn't topped, I don't think, four DraftKings points this year, and just his role in this offense, you're just really hoping to get lucky. And so it's tough to build around this game, but we should go in expecting points to be scored. And in large field play, building some rosters where you say, okay, so where could these points come from? Yes, Lockett has a tough matchup, but maybe the points come through him. Or maybe the Seahawks get Luke Wilson involved because Lockett is covered by Marlon Humphrey. Or maybe Jerron Brown or DK Metcalf just have a huge game. Or maybe Russ does everything on his own and gets 40 points. Or yes, Carson is in a tougher spot, but maybe the Seahawks keep leaning on him and he has a huge game in this spot. Maybe Mark Ingram scores several touchdowns. So there are just pieces from this game that need to be kept in mind in large field play, because you're going to get some pieces from this game wrong, but this game is likely to turn into a higher scoring affair. And so if you're able to build, if you're saying, well, I'm mass multi-entering, I'll build 10 or 15 rosters around this game, you're also going to get some players right, and you could get them right enough with this type of game that those rosters are sitting near the very top of large field tournaments. So that's how I'm viewing that game, is just a really tough game to build around, but a worthwhile game to build around if you're doing mass multi-entry play. So we didn't hit an hour and 15 minutes, but I think we got about an hour and a half. It's about standard for us on this podcast. And we are going to wrap up there. I will see you on, I'll say thanks for hanging out, because that's an hour and a half of your day. And I really do appreciate you hanging out on this podcast and doing this bottom-up build with me and putting us in position for a strong week. So thanks for hanging out, and I will see you on the player grid and whatever else pops up throughout the weekend on the site. And I will see you at the top of the leaderboards this weekend.